Right. So, getting a lot of comments about my hair, so may as well just address it. Some people are texting me about it. So I cut off my hair 2 weeks ago. A dear Dharma brother cut it off for me. It's like it was very joyful, speaking of joy. And one of the joyful things now is that I go to take my hair, a rubber band out of my ponytail, and I don't have one. And I go to put on this mic that I'm usually wrestling with, flipping under my hair, and I don't have hair. So, to tie that into our joy theme for tonight, so far it is very joyful. So, thank you for all of your comments. I don't know that they were all compliments, but thank you for your comments. So how many people are here for the first time tonight? Great. Welcome. And a couple of you, would you mind saying kind of where you're coming from and maybe your name? Yeah. Maria? Yeah, where do you live? Do you live nearby, or if you would?
I live over on Capitol
Great. Thanks. Welcome. Yeah. Do you mind saying? Who else? Yeah. Okay, Max. Yeah, welcome. There's somebody else over here.
Dan from Queen Anne.
Dan from Queen Anne. Okay, rhymes. Great. And how about anyone online? Anyone online joining us for the first time? No one willing to admit it. Okay, all right. Okay. So, as many of you likely know, the theme for the month is joy. And by the time we get to the fourth week of the month, I've likely heard a few talks already about joy. So I'm really interested in your reflections and thoughts about it. So I wanted to say a few things, maybe that haven't been said yet this month, I'm not sure. And then open it up to see what you would like to talk about, or your experiences of contemplating it this month. And what the part that I'd like to reflect on tonight that I'd like to add is the title that I came up with. It's a long one, is Spiritual Playfulness and Irrepressible Joy. So, how about that? Does that sound good? Okay. So, this theme for the year that we're exploring together is transcendent dependent origination or transcendent dependent arising. And it's really not as complicated as that sounds. That does not sound like a joyful title, but what it describes is the path and momentum of awareness and energy as it breaks out of its cycle of repetitive suffering. So there's a cycle of repetitive suffering in which we move from not seeing or ignorance to being caught in suffering. And then if we are not aware, as many of us, as all of us have likely experienced, if we're not aware, suddenly we find ourselves back in the same, what seems like the same position again and again and again. And there's often the experience of, oh, this feels very familiar. I'm kind of stuck in a repetitive loop. Transcendent dependent arising, or TDO, or TDA for short, maps what happens when instead of suffering generating more ignorance, suffer, an experience of suffering generates a moment of inspiration, aspiration, or confidence, sometimes called faith. Confidence, oh, perhaps there is another way. Sometimes it's verbal, sometimes it's dramatic, sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's just the attention and energy that was trapped starts to kind of break out and go in a different direction. So the move is from suffering to some kind of confidence or inspiration. Ah, perhaps this could go a different way. And in that, out of that confidence arises a kind of joy. Yeah, like suddenly I'm in something fresh rather than going around for another cycle. Yeah, suddenly I'm in a fresh moment with new possibilities. And when we get to joy, it's as though we're gaining a bit of momentum. Practice and awareness is gaining a bit of momentum, and we can feel that momentum start to rise, right? On its own, organically. So the image that's used in the teachings is of water that's flowing downhill, right? And it gains a kind of natural momentum as it goes downhill. And as it flows downhill, if you watched water, it kind of finds the path of least resistance, right? So it picks up speed, it finds the path of least resistance, and instead of coming to an obstacle like a rock and getting stuck, it just comes, starts to pool, and then continues to move, right? Just keeps moving, keeps flowing. So in the Upanisa Sutta, that's the image that's used for this kind of alternative pathway. And what it describes is the conditions that give rise to the next condition. Yeah, so sometimes this is translated as supporting conditions. Sometimes it's translated as vital conditions, which I quite like because it's kind of the vitality that gives rise to the next movement or the next momentum. So suffering is the vital condition for, can be the vital condition for faith or confidence. Faith or confidence can be the vital condition for joy. Ah, yes. There is another way. I can go this way and not that way. Yeah, and we can kind of feel our life energy start to resume or get freed up in that. So someone asked Deepa Ma, the wonderful meditation master from Calcutta, who was a lay woman and never ordained, but was esteemed and highly regarded as a very awake being. So people would come and visit her and get teachings from her. And I'm paraphrasing, but someone asked her once, well, this letting go of clinging and desire, it sounds like it would be quite gray and dull. You know, letting go of all desire and passion and clinging. It sounds like it would be a very dull and gray existence. And when she heard this, she burst out laughing. Just burst out laughing and said, oh no, you don't understand. She said, before, it was very gray and dull. It was so repetitive. It was like so much sameness before, but now it's like freshness every moment. Yeah. So now it's clarity and freshness. Every moment is new and fresh. So she was referring to the way that our mind putting together this perceptual puzzle based on memory and associations and links, conditioning from the past, so that it really is that we see kind of what we expect to see, right? Based on memory. The mind puts this puzzle together so we can navigate, but it's based on memories and associations from the past. So if we're not careful and we don't refresh awareness and cultivate awareness, there is this illusion of sameness and repetition that isn't actually the full actuality of what's happening. So when we bring awareness to our experience and let it gain momentum or continuity, the experience is actually one of being in a dynamic and changing flow of experience. So many researchers and scientists have studied the psychology of flow. In the Buddhist tradition, there's a special emphasis that's placed on the wholesome and ethical dimension that gives rise to flow. Right? So it's not just entering a highly attuned flowing state so that we can rob a bank or, you know, take over some, I don't know what you would do, but it's noticing the kind of wholesome flow that arises when we aren't regretting our past experiences, right? When we're not lost in remorse or regret for having caused harm. Then, much like with faith or confidence, that energy can start to go a different direction and gain momentum. Psychologists like Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi have researched flow, and I'm not going to remember all of the elements of it, but it's a common experience across cultures. And it is a state of being that is very joyful and also shares a lot of elements to collectedness or gatheredness or samadhi or concentration. So I like to think of some flow states as like urban samadhi, you know, as samadhi or continuous awareness. When we're in the world, we're not just sitting quietly in a room, deeply absorbed in a meditation object, we're flowing with experience moment by moment, and that's joyful. So the elements that the researchers have put together or have acknowledged or noticed that give rise to flow states are things like novelty, some aspect of the mind being completely absorbed in the activity of what we're doing, and yet somehow also able to see kind of all the moving parts around us. So not hyperfixated on a point, but able to kind of move with the changing elements of the situation in a helpful way. So if you think about an athlete or an artist, or even walking in nature, common experiences where many of us experience a state of flow where we're content to be there. We don't want to be anywhere else. We're undistracted and we're moving with changing conditions. Yeah? It's moving as things come up. So some of the other aspects of that are challenge, and having the skills to meet the challenge that arises. Yep, so a rock climber who has the skills to meet that particular rock face would likely be in a state of flow. Perhaps me trying to climb a rock face, maybe not. Who knows? But it's said in this, at least in this classical research, that we have the skills to meet the challenges of the environment. So many of us, if we've had experience at work or in some maybe playing a musical instrument, where you get to a certain point where you don't have to try so hard just to manage the disparate elements. And in those moments, there can be kind of a state of flow. The wonderful part of this is that in his book on flow, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi was talking about how we approach flow from a Western perspective as opposed to some Eastern ideas of flow. And Western ideas often involve a sense of mastery over one's environment, right? So the basketball player who dominates the competition, right? Or the artist who becomes a master of her medium. But in, especially in the Chinese philosophy, there's a concept of flow, I think originated with Chuang Tzu, I believe, and who called it yu, yu. And this description of flow doesn't involve, it involves many of the same elements, but not mastery. Instead of mastery, it involves spiritual playfulness. Right? So we don't seek to master or dominate the elements around us. We seek to relate and play and flow with them. Right? So I almost shrieked with delight when I read that. Maybe it will not do that for you, but here it is. This is Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. Some critics have emphasized these differences. While flow is often the result of a conscious attempt to master challenges, yu occurs when the individual gives up conscious mastery. In this sense, they see flow as an example of the Western search for optimal experience, which according to them is based on changing objective conditions, confronting challenges with skills, whereas yu is an example of the more classical Eastern approach, which bends entirely in favor of spiritual playfulness and the transcendence of actuality or sameness. Okay, so I'm bringing this up because I think we can get a sense of this in our own experiences as awareness gains momentum, right? So the challenge can be being present no matter what condition we are confronted with, remaining awake and open and aware, no matter what situation comes forward. So in a way, we are bringing that sense of challenge forward with our practice and bringing forward a sense of novelty, which is refreshing our perceptions moment by moment. Sometimes I'll even say to myself, wait, pause, let me see this again freshly. Naomi Shihab Nye has that this wonderful saying in one of her poems called Fresh, awakened eye seeing freshly. Awakened eye seeing freshly. We can refresh our perceptions in a moment. So there's a wonderful playfulness about this when we don't have to feel as though we have to master our environment. That sounds very burdensome to me. I was leading a young adult retreat once, it was a number of years ago, and I was describing how this quality that when awareness gains momentum and this this kind of flow can start to move, this flow of the Dhamma in our lives can start to move and things become less and less effortful and our relationship to conflict or obstacle starts to change. So just like the water comes up to the rock and instead of getting stopped, it just moves and makes another direction around it. So I was explaining this in a retreat and someone afterwards came up to me and said, oh, what you're describing is a lot like what I'm learning in my improv class, right? And so when you're doing improv, you never stop. You never say, no, this shouldn't be happening, right? You learn to say yes and to everything. Like you keep going, you keep moving. You don't ever say this shouldn't be happening. It's all woven in to the play or the dance of form. Yeah, so this is spiritual playfulness. And when we expand it from like the improv class or the rock face or the playing the clarinet, then we do that with life everywhere. Huh? We do it all the time. And that becomes a playful relationship to life. So that is the spiritual playfulness piece that I wanted to bring in. The other part I wanted to mention maybe goes a little bit deeper. I think the second we start analyzing joy and dissecting it and getting too linguistic and intellectual with it, it kills it, right? It kills it. So much better to kind of give some examples and have you reflect on how it's coming forward naturally in your own life and your own practice. So it's not something to be analyzed ad nauseum. So here, on that note, here is a quote from Ross Gay. Many of you may know, wrote The Book of Delights. The Book of Delights. And in this book, he gave himself the challenge of writing a little freeform piece every day for 1 year, from his one birthday to the next. Freeform piece on something that delighted him every day for a year, right? And then he made a book out of it called The Book of Delights. And I think I've got too many things going on here. So often telling people to do one thing at a time, and I've got my notebook and my phone and my computer out at the moment. So I want to, but I really love this quote. So, okay. So this is Ross Gay. Among the most beautiful things I've ever heard anyone say came from my student Bethany, talking about her aspirations or ethos, how she wanted to be as a teacher, and what she wanted her classrooms to be. What if we joined our wildernesses together? Sit with that for a minute, that the body, the life, might carry a wilderness, an unexpected territory, and that yours and mine might somewhere, somehow meet, might even join. And what if the wilderness, perhaps the densest wild in there, thickets, bogs, swamps, uncrossable ravines and rivers, is our sorrow, or the intolerable? It astonishes me sometimes, no, often, how every person I get to know, everyone, regardless of everything, by which I mean everything, lives with a profound personal sorrow. Everyone, regardless always of everything. Not to mention the existential sorrow we all might be afflicted with, which is that we and what we love will soon be annihilated, which sounds more dramatic than it might. Let me just say dead. Is this sorrow of which our impending being no more might be the foundation, the great wilderness? Is sorrow the true wild? And if it is, and if we join them, your wild to mine, what is that? For joining too is a kind of annihilation. What if we joined our sorrow? I'm saying, what if that is joy? So this is certainly a different kind of joy than the joy of spiritual playfulness, but it has this similar freshness and spontaneity to it, this wilderness or this unknowable aspect, this freshness that's in me and you and everyone. And that that we all share in this kind of some degree of sorrow, just by virtue of being human, fragile, not knowing, and that when we join those together, can that also be a kind of joy? Yeah? To not be alone in this human condition. Can that be a kind of joy also? So many images came to mind when I started thinking about this after Ross Gay's quote. When I was living in India for a time, and so much economic disparity between people who had means and people who did not. It was just glaring and everywhere and so apparent. And in the community that I lived in, every day women would come in from the surrounding villages and work really, really hard from morning till night, doing laundry, doing householding tasks, cleaning, and were paid more than most of the women who didn't have those jobs. And it was something just absolutely ridiculous, like $2 a day. And every evening at 4 o'clock, they would all, in this particular community, they would all get off of work, get onto their bicycles with their saris, and head out across this open field and go back home for the day. And it was like watching a configuration of birds just all leaving together at the end of the day, and like moving freely through space after having worked really hard during the day. And there was just so much togetherness in that movement. So it made me feel like there is something about the sharedness of sorrow and the joy that comes from that, that is perhaps not as giddy and light, but is irrepressible, and that it can't be stopped. You know, even given the most grueling conditions, it can't be shoved down. It can't be stopped. So, like us just to perhaps consider this. And of course, activists know that this this kind of spirit of joy is a form of resistance. Right. So in the protests, in the marches, in the civil rights movement, all so many movements throughout time have relied on joy and communal spirit and singing and coming together in a kind of joyful solidarity to rise above the constraints and the limitations of that particular circumstance. Yeah. And that is irrepressible. That is irrepressible. I think it was, maybe it was the, just read this and I can't remember where, activist Emma Goldman, who said, if there isn't dancing, I won't be a part of your revolution. So it's, when this takes hold and it ignites, it cannot be stopped. And it is that the base of that is that deep, deep sorrow, right? Of feeling that sorrow of oppression and what is some degree likely of injustice. So I think when we contact this sharing in this sorrow, we connect not only with each other, but perhaps our ancestors as well, right? And so we can feel part of a lineage, perhaps not just of sufferers or of, you know, a lineage of, you know, harm or people who are not treated well, but a lineage of resistance, of people who found ways to survive the unsurvivable, yeah, who found ways to keep their spirits alive in horrible circumstances. So lots of examples and too many to offer, but I think you probably have your own. Let's see if I can find one more. Yes, so Eddie Hillesum, who I've been read a lot during COVID, because the way my mind works during COVID, I wanted to read about people who had survived difficult conditions with their minds still flourishing, spirit still flourishing. So Eddie Hillesum was a writer and a thinker, philosopher, who died in Auschwitz during the war, but her journals and her letters were thrown out of, some of them survived in the places where she was staying, but some of them also, she was throwing out the window of the train as she was being taken to the camps. So she was throwing her writings out of the train. And they're just beautiful, amazing contemplations. So she says, "I believe that I know and share the many sorrows and sad circumstances that a human being can experience, but I do not cling to them. I try my best not to prolong moments of agony. They now pass through me like life itself as a broad, eternal stream. They become part of that stream, and life continues. As a result, all of my strength is preserved, does not become tagged onto futile sorrow or ineffective rebelliousness." That broad eternal stream reminds me of the flow of water, awareness and energy as it flows downhill. So another image that came to mind, many of you may have seen or heard, is of former President Obama, who had gone to speak to a church in the South, in which the four young girls had been killed, had died in a brutal act. And he was there trying to give encouragement and uplift to this church community in which the violence had taken place. And so he's standing up there, clearly having been deeply affected by what had happened. And he's talking about the integrity and the courage and strength of the community. And then he pauses. And then all of a sudden he starts singing "Amazing Grace." And whenever I'm having a very discouraged day, politically or otherwise, I watch this. Because he's holding so many layers of a very complicated and sorrowful situation. And he's holding it and feeling it and just showing up for it as best he can. And then all of a sudden he starts to sing. And he sings with a lot of feeling and care and depth. And he sings, you know, "Amazing Grace." And then the people behind him, the church elders in the community, the leaders, all of a sudden start cheering and standing up beside him, like kind of almost goading him on, like, "Oh, we were waiting for you to do this." And it is such this poignant mix of sorrow and joy. Just that moment that he starts singing is almost like that leap when life makes a move from what could have been individual collapsing, blaming pain or suffering to collective, joyful, resilient, irrepressible joy. Yeah. Irrepressible joy. And it's almost like the ancestors kind of stand up behind in those moments and say, "Yes, you know, you're in the right place. You can do this," whatever. Likely not that literal, but that legacy of resilience. Okay, So let's sit for just a moment with that. Hopefully that wasn't too sharp of a turn from spiritual playfulness to irresistible joy, but I think there are both. There is both. So just sitting for a moment and noticing what resonates, lands with you. Still, this miraculous body breathing, breath coming in, breath going out, hearing, togetherness. So may each of us remember our capacities for freshness, playfulness. May each of us remember our togetherness in sorrow. And may each of us remember the kind of joy that is irrepressible, strong, hearty. So thank you, everybody. Thank you for your attention tonight. Thank you for your practice. So I'd love to hear some of your own thoughts, reflections, joys from the month. So anything that may have been sparked from the talk or anything in your own practice life this month. Yeah, Candy.
Hi, Andy. I'm trying not to yell into the mic.
Andy?
Andy, yeah.
Oh, okay. I had a C in front. Okay.
No, it's okay.
Yeah, Andy. Great.
I have been struggling this month a lot of thinking about joys that bring me nothing but pure joy. I can't remember what speaker had mentioned this in the beginning of this month, where we were asked to think about like what were some simple pleasures in our day that just brought us nothing of that. But in the last couple of weeks, I've been trying to, you mentioned something about not getting hooked on and analyzing joy and where that's coming from and what that is. And so I started going on after dinner walks every day. I go to Volunteer Park and just walk around. And it wasn't anything intentionally to spark joy at first, but I've been noticing in the last couple days of me doing it that there's this like point of me walking where I feel really like grounded and connected with myself. And it's this fascinating avenue of joy that's not like, oh, I'm looking at this cherry blossom and it's bringing me joy. Even though we think it's beautiful, but it is just this like fascinating wave that I'm processing of like the joy of the stillness and the quietness and just being with myself versus like an activity or an object. Not saying it's persistent, not saying it's not something I analyze afterwards. But yeah, it's a good joyous
That's
moment.
Great. So. That's great. Yeah. Wonderful observations. And the early teachings point to that too. They point to how important it is to get a sense of joy that is like inwardly generated, as opposed to, you know, one of our senses being satisfied, which can be pleasurable too, but of that we can, there's kind of an inward grown, homegrown kind of feeling of joy.
Yeah, so. it's one of those the avenues that I have been struggling to look for the most, because those external ones are, I think, easier for me to identify more. But,
yeah, that's right. And it's not that the external ones are bad. They can be helpful and wholesome also, and they can sometimes lead to the ones that are more like for no reason, you know? Yeah. So like the simplicity of taking a wholesome walk might be joyful because you're with friends, the environment's nice. And then that can be really close to just enjoying one's own, you know, enjoying just being present in oneself. So sometimes we get very kind of idealistic and like it only has to come from here. I'm going to shun all external pleasure. And we just end up getting tight and frustrated. Yeah.
So, thank you.
Thanks.
It.
Great observations. All right, Chuckler, Leslie.
Okay. Today. I've been struggling the last couple of days with back, you know, old tapes. I got to get this done. I got to do, I got to do, I got to do, I got to do.
Yeah.
And I know enough about the practice to know that I don't have to do, but sitting in it has been a challenge because there's this push, right? Well, last night, I didn't have a chance to do that because I had to babysit. And I didn't have to, right? It was a joy to babysit. And I sat down with these two little ones, one is 7 and one is 4, and we wrote a story. And they wrote the story. And there was a scarlet macaw named Absoy, and Maya the not-so-stinky skunk. And I'm telling you, it was pure joy.
Yeah.
They did it.
Yeah.
And it unlocked that place for me.
That's right.
And I didn't know that until this morning when I went, oh.
Yeah.
So anyway, right. It's been really lovely to see Dukkha get changed into this faith, into this joy.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. Great. Yeah. And to recognize that, deepens it. To recognize it happening deepens
yeah,
it.
Yeah, to watch it. I don't think I was able to do that a while back.
Yeah.
So it's been lovely.
And, you know, kids, when they're not being incredibly challenging, are a great avenue to remind us, you know. And one of the amazing aspects of parenting is that you get to see how a mind goes from that irrepressible delight to burdened. You know, you get to watch it happen. And that's it's kind of terrifying and heartbreaking. And but it gives you a lot of compassion for our predicament, you know? So anyway, thank you. That's a delightful kid example.
Lovely. Yeah.
And it reminds me, I was going to use this, but it didn't come up earlier. A couple of months ago, I was at my son's lacrosse game, and they're just at the age where they've gone from really delighting in just running around a field for no reason, you know, throwing things and like just delighting in each other, to really competing. And so we're just at that pressure point.
Yeah.
And so, so there's still delight, but it often is interspersed with competition. And so listening to the coaches, both teams. We have wonderful coaches on our team that are wonderfully encouraging of keeping that spirit alive. The other team's coaches, I had to walk around the track because it was bringing up so much challenge for me. Other coaches were yelling at these 11-year-olds, "Get organized! Get organized!" And we wonder what happens to our innocent, childlike joy, you know? Like, I wonder what could have possibly happened, you know?
Were they talking to themselves or to the kids,
right? Well,
that's
the thing. Yeah. You're always, whenever anyone's yelling, they're always yelling at themselves. But yeah, that's it, isn't it? Like, all of a sudden, there's this natural joy of being to get organized. Gotta get your crap together. And the kids were just rattled. They didn't know what to do with that. They're just totally had its completely the opposite effect that it was intending. So anyway, yeah. It's an aside, but it gave me compassion that this is what happens. This is the culture we're in. Hi, Carla.
Hi, Carrie. So I have totally enjoyed this month. I'm sure most people have. It's given me a lot of joy just to listen to the Dhamma talks and other people's stories of their joy. But what I have had a lot of doubt around was this concept of joy, that it could be something purely innate, and other people have been talking about that. I remember early on in the month, like Tamira was talking about experiences of joy where there was no outward cause. And I kept thinking, I've never experienced that. There's always, it's not necessarily, you know, that I'm getting something I want, but it's, you know, the beauty of nature, or even a very, very subtle, let's say, even if I'm suffering and then I practice with it and I bring awareness to it, there can be a very subtle form of contentment, just knowing, I guess, experiencing my own ability to practice or be resilient, but there's still that outward cause, you know, that I'm relating to. But today, this morning, I had an experience of joy that is making me start to question. I might be wrong. I had a morning of ruminating about something that recently happened that I felt quite upset about. But I kept coming back to awareness of, oh, this is what's happening, and I'm going around in circles. And I was doing yoga while ruminating. So and then towards the end of my yoga practice and the ruminating, I changed posture. My mind was quiet. And all of a sudden, I almost started giggling. I just had a rush of joy. And no thought in my mind. It wasn't like, oh, I'm joyful because I've stopped ruminating or I'm moving on to something more pleasant. There was no thought whatsoever, but there was a rush of joy that truly felt innate. And I can only think that I created the conditions in two ways. I've been thinking about practicing with joy. So when I first woke up this morning, I was a little like, it was hard for me to get up and get going. So there was kind of a depressed mood. And I told myself, I'm just going to be curious about, I wonder where the joy is going to be today. I'm so curious. Where's the joy going to be? What am I going to discover? And I just kind of planted that question in my mind. So I think there was this attitude. And then the thing, I had a very similar thought to the piece you read, by the woman who was on the train to the concentration camp. Mm-hmm. I've been noticing how much energy I waste on resistance or ruminating about things that I'm not actually going to take any action on, right? And that's just been more at the forefront of my awareness. And so I think when I was ruminating this morning, I had enough awareness to keep noticing and keep reminding myself, I'm wasting energy. I don't really want this energy.
Yes.
I just feel like I primed my mind maybe with those two intentions that it suddenly let go and then there was joy.
Great. That's great, Carla. Thank you. Thank you for mentioning that. You mentioned a few things that I think are really important. And one is that attitude of curiosity. Because joy isn't rational, right? It's not like you do A, B, C, and then joy. It's not like you can think your way into it. It's not rational. But if we're curious, if we're kind of hanging out more in don't know mind, but with that kind of curiosity about what we're going to uncover, then that brings that freshness that I was talking about. It's not like, oh, here we go, same old, same old. We're kind of primed for the new to be there, for some new element to surprise us and take hold or arise. And then you also holding that question or that alertness about what might be draining your energy, what might be impeding the natural flow of joy, that's really an important question. I'm sure others have mentioned it this month, but we can start to notice, oh, it's this kind of maybe feeling of external pressure or comparison, or we can get to know kind of what's draining us. Because when that joy comes up, it is like, it's just like life coming forward, like a spring coming forward. It's not that we've created it or we're doing it. It's like a shoot coming up from the ground, like life coming forward, irrepressible. So that's wonderful that you got a sense of that. Yeah, great. And again, I was talking with Andy. I don't think we need to begrudge the joy that we also get from wholesome pleasures outside of ourselves. You know, don't be too stringent with yourself. You know, I can't go take a walk or look at a flower because that's external pleasure. Like, don't do that to yourself. Okay. If it's wholesome, it will lead towards a kind of porousness to our internal, you know, we'll find ourselves coming closer to what Andy described as like just being content to be in being. So, great. All right, maybe there's one or two more, someone here. Oh, Adam. Sorry, sometimes I lose my periphery.
I'm very peripheral tonight.
No, so you're not in the essential sense, just in my vision.
You're right. I just wanted to voice with appreciation you bringing up the second half of what you talked about of joy coming from connecting sorrows. I mean, it's so relevant right now to find that position with life. And it reminded me of another poem. Like, wow, so many poems that talk about this, but that I think people will be familiar with about, you know, I'm paraphrasing and I'm sorry, but like when you are pulling on the string of sorrow until it catches the cloth of all sorrows and you see the size of the tapestry.
Oh, yeah.
And it feels to me like that's a really, like this, that whole part of the talk is this really beautiful, like pathway of the three topics we've talked about this year of like, you have suffering, you have sorrow, you have enough faith to stay with it to hold it.
Yeah.
Until you see that it's not personal. It's
beautiful.
Part of the big connective, collective experience that we have. And that recognition brings ease and brings relief and brings joy. And what a beautiful and important thing to highlight right now.
Do you want to be the closer in all my talks?
I'll send you my application.
That was well summarized. Thank you, Adam. Yeah. No, I appreciate you tying those together. That's Thank you. Yeah. Thanks for that. I think that poem is a Naomi Shihab Nye one also. Can't remember which one right now, but thank you for bringing that thread through. Wonderful. Okay, everybody, so we should probably move towards I'll close tonight. Really appreciate your presence as always, your practice, and your comments. Okay, would just like to take a moment to encourage people to just give some reflection to Donna, if you haven't. So Donna is what sustains us as an organization. So we're mostly all volunteer, and Donna circulates maybe most profoundly through our volunteer community. So yeah, we have very few paid staff. So one important stream of Donna's volunteering, but also your financial contributions go to help support us being here in this space at the University Friends Center. So it goes towards our rent. It goes towards the livelihood of our teachers. It helps enable us to bring teachers, visiting teachers in, and helps sustain our website, and just helps keep the whole thing moving forward and accessible for as many people as possible. So there should never be any sense of expectation, guilt, or pressure around Donna. It should be a source of joy, of contributing and staying in circulation in whatever creative way we can. So thank you for your reflecting on that. And let's just take one moment, so no need to do anything fancy with your posture. But we'll just take a moment, and in whatever way feels natural and right for you, just form the intention that the benefits of our practice be shared. So whatever inspiration, calm, connectedness, insight may have arisen during our time together, may it deeply benefit us, and may it also ripple out and benefit all beings everywhere without exception. May each of us and all beings be well in body and mind. May we all be free of confusion and fear. May we take care of ourselves and each other with ease. And may we continue to move in the direction of greater wisdom, compassion, and freedom in our own unique ways. Everybody.